I think it would be useful for all of us if after each meeting we considered carefully within ourselves what we heard in the meeting. If we consider quietly and silently, there is the most worthwhile assimilation of whatever was valuable in the talk to take place. Otherwise, the mind just loses most of the value of the meeting. Especially if we immediately plunge into any other sort of activity or conversation. Let the mind, let the brain be very quiet for at least a quarter of an hour to half an hour, according to the circumstance, and let an assimilation take place. Now I want you to consider very carefully with me certain very important points. We are all immature mentally. This may sound somewhat harsh, but let us explore together whether this is so or not in the religious context. This is the important point, in the religious context. What is it that specially distinguishes us from all other animal species? What distinguishes us is the mind. We use the word mind. Mankind through the ages has used the word mind. But which man really knows the meaning of mind? What is mind? In our human sense. For most of us, our brain activity, our emotional and intellectual processes mean mind for us. Those are only the trimmings, the external frillery of mind. Even the works of genius, wonderful as they are, largely deal with this frillery and not with an inner depth. They indicate an inner depth. They are searchlights almost, if you like, which, if you and I know how to follow that searchlight, enable us to see that inner depth. But this inner depth is a sensitivity, I have no other word to use in the language, a sensitivity and an energy of which we are almost totally unaware. We think and feel in terms of our own mind, and we have to use that phrase constantly all through our lives. Our minds, or my mind, your mind, or his mind, or whatever it is. This is a misleading phrase. There is no such thing in inward reality as my mind. Mind is something universal, something transcendent. Mind meeting body, the particular living body, gives rise to psyche. And it is the psychological processes and the psychological life which is present in our minds. There you are, I have to use the phrase our minds, when we use the word mind. But as I say, this is just the external wrapping. Our psychological processes are the external wrappings of this one supreme creative energy, which is pure mind. It is so extraordinary that we find it almost impossible to divorce the term, or to distinguish the term pure mind from our concept of mind as psychological processes. Our psychological processes are psychophysical activities. They are psychomaterial, meaning that they are material processes at root, chemical, physical processes, subject to analysis by chemistry and physics and so forth. At root, they are that. But because of our faculty of speech, which integrates all our sense impressions, because of that faculty of speech, we have this psychical aspect. And we think that that is mind. It is mind in a sense, yes, of course. But it is not mind in that supreme inward religious context, which means that mind is a transcendent reality for us as we are. Now, the body, as you know, is the product of evolution. Structure and function always go together. When the structure through the evolutionary process undergoes certain changes, it means that certain more developed or new functions, or the possibility of new functions, is now present. So, structure and function go together like that. And this psychophysical organism, which is the characteristic organism of the human race particularly, and certain other animal species also, this psychophysical organism is something which has grown out of a very primitive condition. Now, in man, the trend is towards the release of a transcendent function which we call mind. This universal sensitivity. Do you know of any animal whatsoever that has a sense of universality, a sense of totality, of non-finitude, of perfection? I don't know any such animal. But man has that. He has that sense. And this is the new thing functioning in the human species. And it is this which is trying to come to fruition and fulfillment in man. When it is there in fruition, then the mind is mature in man. That is to say, you and I, as individual men and women, will display a maturity and a harmony of the psychical and physical aspects of ourselves, which we'll represent as perfectly as is possible for human beings to express this transcendent reality which is mind. This is what we are working towards. Now, until that takes place, or until our life moves in that direction, we are not only immature in mind, in the religious sense, but living as we do at a level which belongs to the past, our past evolution, the animal level only, we produce sorrow, difficulty, complication, dis-ease, the absence of ease. We are not at home in the universe. You look at your ant or your tiger or any other creature, you look at your tree, as far as I can see, they are all at home in the world. But I, an ordinary man, am not at home in the universe. You see? Instead of being at home, I am in difficulties always. I am in misery. I'm making a mess of things. The whole history of the human race is one long muddle after another. There are its bright spots, of course. If they were not there, we should have been exterminated long ago. There are the bright spots, and it is those bright spots which are the lamps of light which shine for those who are willing to see, who are silent and quiet within themselves, and will let their eyes be affected by that light. When that happens, your whole life changes inwardly within yourself, and the process of the maturation, the maturing of the mind, begins to grow apace. then you are truly on the path as the old great founders of the religions and other spiritual teachers taught. Otherwise, we are not even fiddling about with the path. We are right off it. We are playing with it. We are satisfying our vanity, our ego. We are running away from the actual reality which is present here now, and so on. Anything but religion in the real deep sense. Do realize that. The first things are the hardest to realize. The very first things. Those are the most difficult. And they are the most distressing to us. Because it hurts our vanity and our ego conceit. And we are brought up on vanity and ego conceit. Aren't we? I am the strong fellow. Come on, lassie, you take me, not him who is the weak fellow. I am the beautiful one. Come on, laddie, you take me, not that other slip of a creature. Ego and vanity, all along the line, functioning in animal terms, which means in terms of conflict, not in terms of harmony. Now, what is the supreme instrument for this release of the mind so that it will come to maturity? It is not a system, a doctrine. It is not a set of ideas. It is not a question of a mechanical practice of what I have been told by my teacher or guru or what was in the books. What was in the books is always misleading to me for the very simple reason that I, the immature man, read the words without the mind, the penetration of true mind, to understand their real inner significance. I mistranslate them invariably and inevitably in terms of my conditioning, my imperfection, my drawbacks. We can't avoid this. This is the fact of the matter. But we are so immature in mind that we are never aware of it. And if somebody points it out, we don't like him very much. Oh, he's a harsh taskmaster. I think I'll go to that teacher. He's such a nice fellow. Well, please do go to any and every teacher and find out the teacher. And by the time you've found out, you will find that their eyes are at last inward looking, not outward looking. Your feet are no longer led astray into the byways and alleyways, but your standing still and moving entirely with the stream of life, which means your growth, your fulfillment, your maturation of mind. So it is not a doctrine or a teaching or a set of ideas or any sort of instructions. You will go for all of them because you are grasping. You're grasping for salvation. You're grasping for happiness, predefined by you yourselves. And every single definition is false, because happiness and salvation are infinite. They are universal. How will you define that which is not finite and therefore not definable? You see, you and I, we can't let life be. We are frightful interferers. Enfants terribles. Excuse my French, sir. You see, now we really must see this. You've got your chance here now, in the right surroundings, in the right circumstances. In one word, we can sum up the essence of this inward lookingness, this standing still, this allowing ourselves to grow happily in the silence. That word is mindfulness. Perfect mindfulness. We use the word. Have we ever thought of the meaning of that word? And if we have thought of the meaning of the word, if you have really considered it in the quiet, didn't you notice that you're like a squirrel in a cage running round and round, held in by your conditioning, your preconceptions and your assumptions? And every single one of them is unwarranted in truth. Every one of them is false. And it is in the discovery of the fact that, this is false, that is false, that is false, that the falsity disappears. Once you see the dust and the little bit of litter in the room, now you can use your dustpan and brush and off with it, and the room is clean. But you must see it, mustn't you? And whose eyes can see it but your own eyes? You can't borrow another person's eyes. Mindfulness. This thing, mindfulness, is the linchpin of the whole discipline of the religious life. And if mindfulness is there, present all the time, you will find that at last one lives sensibly. Because mindfulness essentially means the perfect use of the senses in the first instance. And after the perfect use of the senses, the interpretive activity of the brain in relation to the sense impressions comes to rest, complete rest, whilst the sense impressions go on, but this inner sensitivity, which is the opening up of the way to universal mind, begins to function, to operate. And all the sense impressions then are no longer the dividers of oneself from others and from the world, but they are the cords of communion. The purification of the senses means that. So now you see how it is tied up with silence. And silence and mindfulness shall be the keynotes for this week. The speech activity, the speech function which we possess, is one of the most remarkable functions of the human being. And it is far and away the most misused function. The speech function. all our mental processes, as we call them, all our psychological processes, all our cognitions, both of sense impressions as well as of what we call abstract ideas, are all bound up with speech, language. Now you see, it has not been the good fortune of the human race to have experienced upbringing by parents who are already wise, or education by teachers who understand life, its meaning, its significance, and the direction in which it moves. Therefore, we are like children lost in the forest or the desert, amidst a forest infested with wild beasts. And those wild beasts are our own passions, our whims, our appetites, and so forth, which are part of our animal heritage, spoilt and misled by our incessant chatter. Incessant chatter. Now watch this chatter all the time. The silent chatter that goes in the mind when you are not bringing the roof down with conversation. It is all round the self. I, all the time. You can't think of two consecutive sentences without the word I being present. So you see, that means we are at the animal stage. It's the business of the animal to draw the world unto itself for its self-preservation and its sustenance. But when that has been done, and the body is sustained and is all right and comes to its natural maturity, which nature does for all of us, the next stage is in mind and consciousness to go out of this minute, finite, infinitesimal center here, out into totality. That is our task. So now, when this chatter ceases in the mind, in the brain, then this profounder aspect of mind begins to function. And it can come to flower. And that means the maturity of the mind. And when mind is matured through mindfulness, constant, unceasing mindfulness, even in your sleep it will go on. All the great teachers have taught that. You find it explicitly stated in both the Upanishads as well as in the Buddhist texts that the mindfulness goes on when you are asleep. This is one of the great meanings of the statement in the Upanishads, that the yogi is free from sleep. He never sleeps, they say. And of course, all the dear people, I know in India they do, they go rushing along to become yogis so that they'll never fall asleep at any time. They'll be awake all the day and do some marvelous magical nonsense. It's all rubbish. The body must sleep. But you can put the body to sleep mindfully, and this mindfulness, this awakened state, goes on in the quiet. And that is the meaning of the statement that the yogi never sleeps. So now you see, mindfulness is the linchpin of the discipline of the religious life. The very linchpin. But do understand clearly what mindfulness means. there are some very interesting discourses in the Pali Canon about mindfulness. They are an external presentation, an external presentation which is of the utmost value if you know how to peel off the skin, which is the external presentation, and find the fruit inside. That is your task. And it is a task which is best done in stillness and in silence. You may be as active as you like, driving your car at 70 miles an hour, working in the kitchen, digging the garden, putting out the fire which is burning up the house, and be completely and totally mindful all the time. You may be dancing with your sweetheart till the small hours of the morning and thoroughly enjoying yourself. Of course, enjoy yourself. But be mindful all the time. Or you may be facing problems in deep misery. Be mindful all the time. Because all these things which come will inevitably go. But the mindfulness will remain. And when that state of mindfulness is well established in you, and the mind in the religious context is coming to maturity, you will be fulfilling the purpose of your existence here and now. I use the phrase, being at home in the world, a little while ago. Mindfulness is the essential means for enabling us to be at home in the world. Let us first understand what is the fundamental meaning of the phrase in the world. First and foremost, the world means one's own living organism. You remember how the Buddha said, in this fathom-long body, I declare the beginning and ending of all things, the escape from ill, and so forth. In this fathom-long body, this is the world, first and foremost, in the religious context. What is commonly called oneself. This world, oneself, is a miniature of the cosmos, which is the world as a whole. Have we ever been sufficiently sensitive and really seen the truth of the fact that the difficulties and problems and troubles of the world which we talk of as being outside oneself, are only our own disharmonies and difficulties and troubles on a macrocosmic scale? Each one of us is the microcosm. And the affairs of mankind and the nations of the world is oneself on the macrocosmic scale. Note how we are critical of everything outside us. This party doesn't know how to do things, that party does. That expresses the fundamental conflict in our own selves. Inside our own selves are embodied all the parties, all the achievements, all the failures and muddlements. Because the world is what we make it. This is our special responsibility. But we are not mindful of it. Nature brings the living organism to maturity. Then it hands over to us as individuals the further task of ourselves being brought to maturity and fruition. So that it is always essentially our own personal individual responsibility. Now, this personal responsibility can never be delegated to another. Nor is it possible to discover what is one's personal responsibility by asking another, listening to another, reading a book, and so on. Because, as I mentioned earlier this morning, everything is interpreted by us as we are. We hear certain words. But are we hearing the other person's realization of truth, assuming that the other person has realized truth? We are hearing words whose meaning is completely conditioned, twisted, distorted by our own drawbacks and conditioning. So hearing the word of the scripture, hearing the word of the truth, spoken out of the lips of angels, if you like, does not do what we imagine it does for us, because we spoil the word of truth. We falsify it. Our own psychological processes and our speech faculty, those are the two at play particularly, which falsifies the truth. Now, time and again, we come up against difficulties in life. And immediately, we think in terms of solving those difficulties in some manner or other, which will bring about a desired result. This is the nigger in the pile, the drawback. My will, not thine, O Lord. I dislike this, it is painful. I want it otherwise, and I know precisely what that otherwise is. I make the shape. I, who am not the pure fool, but the other type of fool, have the conceit to make a shape of what my future ought to be. And so I travel from one darkness to another. I am in the shadow, but I don't like this shadow. And I want to get out of it into what I consider light. But what I consider light, I always discover is only another shadow. Haven't we all done that through our lives? Stumbled from one stupidity to another? And why is this? Why does this happen? Why does this brain, which really is such an extraordinary instrument, there is nothing like the human brain amongst all the animal species of the world. Why is it that the human brain does this? This intellect on which we pride ourselves so much, this logical intellect. Note carefully, it is a logical intellect. The word, logos, language, speech, it's all tied up with speech. Why does this logical intellect continue to make mistakes? Because this logical intellect is the slave of the desires, the conditioned reflexes, and the instincts which we derive through our animal heritage. Look at all the plans that are put forward by politicians, economists, and a whole lot of them, every single one of them, all the worldlings, the irreligious ones. And in amongst worldlings, I include all the so-called religious ones who throw out carrots to you of nirvana, kingdom of heaven, happiness, health, fitness, beauty, and all the rest of the claptrap. Look at all their plans. What do they appeal to? To you as the separate self, the gain and the aggrandizement of this separate self, which is the very root of all conflict, disorder, disharmony, immorality, as well as unmorality. That is why the whole social order is rotten and has been through the ages. That is why. Because the intellect is the slave of this animal desire in us. Now, in making plans, in using our intellect, as we are doing it, we are unmindful. We do not observe as true observers. We are all the time desiring and planning in accordance with that desire in relation to every single sense impression we get, every single idea, every single thought, every single feeling that comes up in us. Our lives are terribly ego-centered. We refuse to be born into our true manhood, our true humanity. Most of the living beings in the world, the living human beings, are all like stillborn creatures, moving about like automata. Daleks and whatnot. I'm going to be very fierce this morning. We really are a horrible lot of creatures. Now, I do want you to see that. Because if you really see it, don't take my word for it, for goodness sake, because then you will certainly not see it. If you do see that, you will blossom out in beauty, the very opposite of horribility, now, this moment. We are observant in this self-centered way. What we see, what we hear, what we touch, what we taste, what we smell, what we feel, what we think, all this comes within the sphere of sense functioning, is done unmindfully. And unmindfully essentially means it is related to us ourselves. what is done mindfully has no relationship to a separate self center. Do try and really understand this. Keep your minds quite open and at ease. Really understand this. What is done mindfully has no relationship to a self center. As I said earlier, mind is this indescribable, unthinkable, unimaginable, transcendent, universal, total reality. Where is the self in that? Where is the center? The center is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere. And nowhere, in the English language anyway, as spelt in English, becomes now here. So it comes right back to you yourself. And when you see that, when your inner eyes are really open, you realize the truth of the transcendent. That in the embodied, in the limited and the finite and the particular, is the infinite, the not particular. Which means also, therefore, that in this which is our suffering and muddlement and so forth, is also the beatitude of perfection and of blessedness. You see the meaning of the mercy and the grace of God, as the theistic religions put it. If I make my bed in hell, I shall find thee there. Our beds are in hell. Now, the moment you and I become mindful of that, unrelated to the self-center, which wants to throw away this bed because I don't like the color of the bed sheet or because it is a bit too narrow, or it creaks and so forth and so forth. If I'm truly mindful of the bed as the bed, then out goes all the discomfort of the bed. Now you see more and more how no one else can do it for you. This is the way one has to be mindful. Not that I am suffering this, that I am doing wrong, that I am making a mess, etc. But here is a mess, here is suffering. And suffering affects all manifestation. Until the eyes of the manifest turn inwards and open to the transcendent reality embodied in the limited and the particular. Now, if we can be mindful this way, we will find that we cease to be critical in the worldly sense of the term critical. We see the fact for what it is, exactly as it is, but we have no animosity towards it, no hate towards it, nor are we afflicted with the conceit of wanting to rush in and put it right. What a marvelous conceit. I am going to put the universe right. Clever fellow, aren't I? Said he sarcastically. But this is the fact. We all do it. All rushing about, evangelizing, perfecting, telling the other chap what to do. What about, what is it, beams and motes in the eye? To put it in another form, we are totally incapable of shutting up, keeping our mouths shut. If you and I can keep our mouths shut, except when there is the absolute necessity to speak during these 8 days, the very next step will be nirvana itself. No, I'm quite serious about this. Our chattering is a curse, a real curse to ourselves and to everything around us. Look at the chatter that goes on, mischievous, untrue, gossipy, envious, ambitious, conceited, lying, devilish, troublemaking, confusion-producing, misleading. My store of adjectives is exhausted. We are not mindful. Be mindful, and the word you speak will be the word of love and healing. It will bring blessing. It will be a benediction around you. Your unspoken words will be a benediction around you, because they will be the word of truth then, of the reality. They will be mindful words. And mindful words are words which are in tune with life, with the stream of life. And this is what we are trying to do, aren't we? We all have this passion to continue to live. Mankind is afflicted with the passion to continue the carcasses that walk about on the face of the globe, instead of angels enfleshed. So be mindful. And in being mindful, the whole barrage of chatter, which is critical or approving, which is charged with animosity, disaffection, and so forth, or with sentimental attachment, with misjudgments, with utopian appreciations of what is not true of the person. See, both ways we are at the extremes. We talk of the middle way, and all we do is stretch our legs out to the extremes until we split. We are not mindful. When the self-center disappears, all that will be absent. And the self-center will disappear when all this is absent. It's a mutually interdependent situation. You can't say to yourself with the logical intellect, oh, now I shall be mindful and I shall be kind and loving and so forth. You and I don't know the meaning of kind and loving. Leave that to God. God alone knows what it means to be kind and loving. You and I don't. Take that for granted. Start with the fact that I don't know. And if we can really know, certainly in these 8 days, that each one of us does not know, then at last we start clean and well washed, outside and inside. When that takes place, the king can speak. When I am speechless, then only the king speaks. And the word of the king is the word of absolute authority, which is completely non-compulsive, but which in the speaking moves the streams of life to fulfillment through you in terms of your well-being and your happiness and your flowering out. It is not easy to realize this. The intellect won't see it. But be mindful in the true sense. Therefore, not I am this, or I feel that, or I have thought this, etc., etc. But this is the thought that is present in the mind. This is what is being seen or heard, etc. When you get this impersonality out of the center, which is the living being who is a personality, then all the limitations and drawbacks imposed by self-conscious, self-centered personality are out of the situation. And then this transcendent thing, which is mind, begins to operate and function freely through you. This is something like the wisdom of the gods, the wisdom of the holy ones. Now you will find that mindfulness is easy. Mindfulness in the true sense becomes easy. It's not difficult. Why is it not difficult? You're no longer struggling for yourself. If the self-center is gone, if you know that this is the person who has this particular name and is this particular person, that is quite sufficient for moving about in the world. If only that is there, then all the rest of your awareness is in terms of the totality of everyone around you and everything. Then there is the possibility of mindfulness. And you are mindful easily. You are at ease. You are, in fact, beginning to be at home in the world. Your own living body, to start with. And since your consciousness is not imprisoned within the confines of your living body, your body will gradually include all other bodies around you. Unless you're completely out of your senses, you won't take a knife and plunge it into your gizzards, into your own gizzards. But we do that mentally almost every day with somebody else, don't we? Plunge the knife of criticism or anger or whatever it is into somebody else's gizzards. But when you really are free of that, then you'll see that all other bodies are the one body. See, I believe this is something like the true meaning of the word church as it exists in Christendom. The one body. And this is the holy body, the pure body. The whole body. And if the body is whole in that sense, both individually and particularly as well as universally, then the mind and the body are in a whole and transcendent unity, in a true unity. So you will see that mindfulness is the very heart of the whole business of awaking to the total reality. This sort of mindfulness, not this self-centered mindfulness which has an ulterior motive. I shall walk thus, I shall sleep thus, I shall eat thus, and so on, very, very mindfully, because in 7 years or in 7 lives, as the case may be, I shall become a non-returner and I shall become the Arahant, the worthy one, or reach Nirvana, or so forth and so forth. Don't take the trouble to go to Nirvana. It's an awful bother. Nirvana is here right inside you. If you and I just shut up and let be and become free of the self-center, here is Nirvana. Haven't we all met people who have talked with deep feeling, "Ah, if I had been present in the days of the Buddha, or if I had been present when Jesus Christ taught, or Sri Krishna, etc., etc., I would have not let us take Jesus. I would not have forsaken him in the hour of his trial. Darling liars. Extraordinarily deluded creatures that we are. The chances are we would have done worse. You see, we have all these self-misconceptions. So leave Nirvana alone. Don't obstruct it. It will come through by itself. The root of it, mindfulness. Now, if this enters life, then you will find that even in the midst of all the noisy clatter and chatter that we indulge in, we can be mindful. But you can bet your bottom dollar that 99% of the clatter and chatter will disappear also. Mindfulness is an extraordinary thing. It's indescribable. Now, why is it really indescribable? We can the Buddhist scriptures particularly have presented it in the greatest detail. I talk about it a little bit. Other people talk about it a little bit. Why is it so extraordinary? Mindfulness, which starts as an external practice, something done with effort, reaches that point where it never stops, it never fades away. And in that not fading away of mindfulness, you are permanently in communion with the total reality. Have you ever seen that? This is the tremendous significance of this mindfulness. Why should two such spiritual giants like the Buddha and Jesus have both said the same thing? Samasati, watch. Samasati and Samasamadhi, watch and pray. They are the identical thing. So this mindfulness becomes permanently established, permanently functioning. The mind is mature. And when the mind, the psychophysical manifestation of mind through us, when that is mature in the real sense, you will find that this is constant meditation. We say 4 o'clock meditation or 6 o'clock meditation or something like that. But do you know that every second of time is in constant meditation with the infinitude of all eternity? Do you know that? Can you feel it? If we are truthful, we'll say we can't. And why? Because we are so full of the self. We are so hemmed in by this immaturity that we are unmindful of every second of time as it flows past. Science today knows of time in such incredible terms as a thousand millionth of a second. And science can deal with that quantity to produce results. But the scientists are unmindful that thousand millionth of a second is eternity embodied. Because eternity is nothing static. It is creative life, vibrant, poised, perpetually in action. The action which is pure karma, beyond all consequence, all cause and effect and so forth. Perpetual creation. And that is the mindfulness, if you like, of transcendence itself, its total reality. Now that is the sort of thing that is trying to come to fruition through us as individuals. Its manifestation in the world is through us. Just as they say in Christian terms that Jesus was the manifestation of God. God we cannot know in his absoluteness, but we see his manifestation in the world. The Hindus say that Krishna was God incarnate. And there are those aspects of Buddhism which present the Buddha in a similar manner. Not identical, of course, because each one has its own uniqueness. In a similar manner. And so this mindfulness is something of such importance that if we can ever penetrate into its depth, the purpose of existence will come to fruition through us as such. Then you will be mindful at ease all the time. Mindful, never unmindful. Whatsoever may be happening externally. And in this connection, there is one practical problem that faces us. All day and every day. We may be mindful now and now and now, and then find that we have slipped, we have become unmindful. Something has happened and we have become unmindful. And you will notice every time that what has happened is that our attention has been, as we call it, distracted. This distraction of the attention is a serious problem. Until you see into the nature of the problem, then it is no longer a problem. The distraction of attention is a problem because the books so far, through the past centuries, have taught us in all religious disciplines that when the mind wanders, bring it back. When attention is distracted, bring back your attention upon the matter in hand. And that is a mistake. With apologies to all the scriptural texts. That means that you are going to produce and perpetuate conflict. In the conflicting state, you cannot be mindful. You are fighting. That is not mindfulness. And one is fighting, and one tries to compel the mind, to slave drive the attention to come back to a particular point, because there is the self-center, the demon in us, dominant. He wants a result for himself. So they talk about the concentration of the mind, and all brows become furrowed, somewhat like mine is, permanently. No, that is a mistake. That is not mindfulness. There is no such thing as exclusiveness where mindfulness is concerned, where true attentiveness is concerned. In the religious context, mind you, in the context of worldly affairs which are tied in terms of time and things to be done, the situation is different. I'm talking of the religious context, which means the bringing of the mind to maturity. If my mind or my attention wanders from the matter in hand, my business is not to force it back to the old matter, but to follow where the attention went. What has it gone to? And if I am truly following it, then I am following it mindfully and not because I am fascinated by the other thing, not because I am captivated like a child is entranced with a little new toy which you give it, but I am observant in the total sense. So I maintain both mindfulness and attentiveness. And when I am mindful of the fact that, yes, I am attending to that now, you will find that you will see the relationship to this from which the attention wandered. Why will you see the relationship? How is it that you will see the relationship? Mindfulness and pure attentiveness do not come under the domination of time and circumstance, that is, of anything which is limited. They are timeless. They belong to the realm of totality. In the realm of totality, everything is contained. Nothing is unrelated. So you will find that when you maintain the mindfulness that way, by being attentive to where your attention has wandered, being aware of the fact that my attention has gone there, you are really awake to that fact, you will find that the link will re-emerge, if necessary, for your well-being. Because there is no desire, no personal desire, and all personal desire limits. Every single personal desire. Because it's shaped in relationship to the separate self. That is why. There is no such thing as a universal desire. It's only the creative drive of the world. So now, that is the way we can deal with this problem of the wandering of the attention, and therefore maintain perfect mindfulness constantly.